Hi, everybody, and this is Kathy Hatch, and I'd just like to welcome everyone. This IELTS conversation, as usual, is presented by the IELNet, National Training and Technical Assistance Program of Independent Living Research Utilization. That's ILRU for all you folks who love acronyms, and was organized and facilitated by me at April. So we're happy you could join us and looking forward to a lively discussion. This is a neat topic, so I hope we can get lots of discussion going. We have about an hour and a half, so we'll start out with an introduction of the speakers, and they'll talk about increasing financial capability and growing consumers' personal wealth. So we want to keep this as conversational as possible, and it sounds like we have a small crowd today, but there hopefully will be some more folks joining. And I know questions will come up as we go through the material. So the presenters will start, and we'll open it up for questions and answers, and that'll be kind of following the presentation. But if you have a really burning question during the presentation, do feel free to ask. We do want to hear from you. So a little bit of housekeeping before we start. First, if you go to the april-rural.org website, you'll see the information for today's call, and it also has the link for CART for our captioning services today. So if you go there, you'll see that, and that should be on the front page. So I'd like to ask everybody to go ahead and put your phones on mute, and that's *6. And the reason we do that is because British Isles are pretty sensitive, and they tend to pick up background noise and distortion sometimes. So if you'd put it on *6, I'd appreciate it. Also, if anybody is using a cell phone or a speakerphone, we may need to ask you to switch to a landline if you can, because those also tend to cause distortion. So far, so good, though. And once we get to the Q&A part, I'll try to moderate that discussion. But again, if we can be as courteous as possible, just try not to talk over each other, that'd be great. So, now I'd like to introduce our presenters today, and I'll just begin by telling you a little bit about each one of them. First, we have Tom Foley, and he is the Deputy Director of the World Institute on Disability. Trained as a lawyer, Tom Foley's professional experience includes more than 25 years as an advocate in the independent living movement, focusing on wealth planning, employment policy, emergency preparedness, tax policy, and information technology access in employment, government, and education. During his tenure at WID, he's developed and influenced federal and state legislation to encourage employment and increase participation of people with disabilities in employment and wealth-building programs. Tom's extensive experience providing financial training has extended to more than 45 states, plus Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, and he regularly lectures at the University of California, Berkeley. Jacqueline Welks is an outreach specialist with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Office of Financial Empowerment. Jackie joined CFPB in March of this year, where she's tasked with creating active, meaningful, and long-term partnerships with organizations across the country that serve low-income and economically vulnerable consumers, including individuals with disabilities. Prior to coming to CFPB, Jackie lived in Atlanta, where she was the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Center for Financial Independence and Innovation, whose mission is to provide financial products and services to individuals with disabilities, their family members, and caregivers. And ultimately, the goal of the Office of Financial Empowerment, which is where she is now, is to ensure that all Americans, those with and without a disability, have access to accurate, timely, relevant, and accessible information that will empower them to make informed financial decisions. So again, they're here to talk today about increasing consumers' financial capability. And now I'd like to turn it over to Jackie Wilkes. Jackie? Are you there? Come off mute? Jackie? Uh-oh.
Well, I can jump in here. I'm sure I know Jackie was looking for a quiet place where she could participate in the call. So
okay. That
might be part of what's going on.
That's great. This is Tom Foley who's speaking. So go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Hey, everybody. And thank you, Kathy, for the invitation to participate today. We really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And it's gonna, you know, I really also appreciated the part you said about this being a discussion, and because it's always a lot more interesting, and I think folks get more out of it when we can sort of go back and forth. So that's one of the reasons I'm really interested in the discussion part, and the other part is that my computer just gave me the blue screen of death. This is going to be without any notes at all on my end of the world today. So this is going to be really exciting for me. So again, it's great to be here. And I'm Thomas William, the Deputy Director at the World Institute on Disability. And I'll talk a little slower for the CART person. I'm always heavily caffeinated, and that never goes well for CART. Anyway, so, you know, one of the things that we've really focused on a lot here at WID is, you know, not only employment, but really trying to work on increasing the financial capacity of folks with disabilities. And we've done this, we've been at a bunch of April conferences over the years, and we have a chance to do these presentations. Because I think a lot of times folks focus on employment because it's so important, but also, you know, what can we also do from like a personal finance perspective to really change some of the economic outcomes for folks with disabilities? So that's one of the things we're going to talk about today, and we're going to sort of just take a really big picture overview to, you know, four or five or six things that folks can do that can really make a substantial long-term difference in people's financial capacity and financial outcomes as they go forward. One of the first things I wanted to talk about, and, you know, Jackie, if you're there and just want to chime in at any point, please feel free.
I got kicked off a minute ago, but I'm back.
There you go. Excellent. Do you want to say hi before I sort of jump in? Kathy introduced you and the line had gone dead. You want to jump in for a moment?
No, go ahead, start yours, and I'll do a brief introduction before I lead into my work here.
Okay, great. I don't know if you were on, Jackie, but I just got the blue screen of death on my machine, so I'm going, this is going to be exciting. One of the places that I think that we like to start talking about, and I think this is for folks with disabilities and anyone really, is starting out with the idea of a banking relationship. You know, there's been data floating around in the asset building world and the disability world that, you know, up to half the disability population are folks without a checking account and a savings account. So whenever we talk about this stuff, one of the things we always start with is just, you know, the importance of that banking relationship, the importance of starting a banking relationship. And we've been doing some research out here around folks on resistance to this. And, you know, one of the things that we've heard is that, you know, the banks aren't necessarily as approachable as some of these other places, and that they're more expensive. And in the short term, that can be true, not necessarily in the long term. So let me give you an example. One of the things that we've heard is that, you know, to cash a check, it's only a 2% fee if you go to one of these payday lenders or check cashers. And, you know, while that might only cost $2 if it's a $100 check, you know, for a more significant check, that can be, you know, significantly more expensive. So one of the things that we really like to look at is really what are the big and long-term costs of having a banking account versus not having a banking account. And so, you know, obviously there are lots of low-cost and affordable bank accounts out there. One of the things that we really recommend is that folks look at credit unions. They're an excellent option for finding low-cost banking relationships. And in addition to that, you know, lots of these financial institutions, credit unions and banks alike, you know, often provide free checking accounts with direct deposit, and often part of that is free online bill pay is also included, you know, which can provide a substantial savings just from a postage perspective, as well as a time perspective. I'm getting a bunch of feedback on my line. Is it still okay, Kathy?
I'm hearing it.
Okay, is that... I'm still on a headset. Okay, it seems to have gone away. Is that still a reasonably clear line?
It's clear for me now.
Okay, great, thank you, whoever that was. It's a voice out of the ether. So anyway, banking accounts are sort of the first step in, you know, developing a good financial future. Again, direct deposit with direct deposit, and then obviously people are also avoiding check cashing fees. It just makes us nuts when we hear about people taking, you know, an SSI check, which is guaranteed by the government, to a, you know, check casher, and they're charged, you know, 10, 15, 20, depending on the part of the country, it can be even more than that, bucks to cash a check that, you know, basically has no chance of bouncing. One of the other aspects of the banking relationship is that it also helps keep folks away from payday lenders and predatory lenders. And I'd be interested to actually hear from anyone on the line if you guys have experienced this. But you know the deal. You know, it's the end of the month. People are a little short on cash, and they go and get one of these loans. Interest rates vary, but these loans, you know, can be anywhere from, you know, 200% to 400% implied interest rate. They don't say that, of course. What they do instead is, you know, there are fees. There's the origination fee, there's the payoff fee. You know, a lot of times, let's say you want to borrow $200, what you agree, you come in on the 15th, you need $200, you agree to pay that back in 2 weeks. Well, you don't actually get the $200. You get $160, but you have to pay $200 at the end of the month. So that's a $40 fee for a $160 loan that, you know, is due within 2 weeks. Yes, ma'am.
Isn't it required that an SSI check is deposited into a checking now, so they wouldn't have a paper check to cash?
That's a really good point. I thought that some of those regulations had been pushed back a bit. Is that not your understanding?
Well, in Maine,
they get issued either a card from Social Security that their money gets voted on every month, or they are required to have a checking account that the money goes into. So that's required, at least in Maine. I'm not sure where else it would be different.
This is Jackie. I can chime in a little bit on that, Tom, if you don't mind. Primarily, yes. The SSI checks are either coming as a direct deposit to a person who has an account, either a checking or a savings account, or on some type of prepaid benefits card. There are, however, apparently some sort of waivers that are existing, and what I'm sort of hearing is it's like for older Americans who just have insisted on maintaining paper checks. So I think that there still is a small portion of people that have managed to maintain getting those checks. But I don't think it's a very high number. I would say that Tom's point is really, I think, should be taken very seriously around the check cashing fees, if not for the SSI checks, but just in general.
Okay, can I ask everybody to please do, this is Kathy, I just did it myself, say your name so that we get that on the cart, if you would, before you start to speak. Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Great. Well, thanks. So, and that's a really, thanks for the clarification there, Jackie. In addition to the an SSI check or a DI check or whatever the check might be, especially when folks are working or maybe working part-time, you know, it's another area where we really want to make sure that folks with disabilities are avoiding payday lenders. Partially because of the fees attached and partially because, you know, the products that these folks are selling are, you know, not very good for consumers. I'm just curious for folks on the line, have you run into the payday lending catastrophe much? I know we've seen a little bit of it out here in California. We've also seen a very similar product, and I know that Jackie's organization has been looking at this as well, is the title loans against cars, sort of the same concept. You need some money, they make a loan against your vehicle, even accessible vehicles. with really high fees and really high interest rates. Have folks seen that much?
This is Sky in Matsu Valley in Alaska. I've seen it on a number of my folks because we run a grant out of this office as well, and I'm finding that when we inquire as to why it is they got behind on certain bills, we're finding more and more of these title loans and the payday loans, and they're basically only able to pay whatever the fee is and never able to really pay off onto the loan. No matter what they do, all they're paying is these fees. To the point that we've, I know that there's an advocacy group, not ours, that's now getting involved with our local politicians to kind of try and regulate a little bit as to what they're doing, because they seem to be going right after our Social Security folks for whatever reason. So.
Great. Yeah, I've seen that in various places all throughout the country. And Sky, if it's all right with you, I'd love to pass that on. I have an opportunity to talk to some folks next week in D.C. around that sort of issue. So if I could actually get your contact info maybe at the end of this, or you could ping me with an email, that would be great.
Perfect. Yeah, is that going to be at the Seoul conference?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to be at the Seoul conference?
Yes.
Yeah, there's our boss, Camille, so she's going to be there, too.
Oh, fabulous. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Okay, so, great, bank accounts and payday lenders. So, you know, that sort of leads into one of the other topics that that is always really popular in any sort of, you know, financial planning arena. I think it was next up on the agenda. Kathy, do you have the agenda in front of you, actually?
I can pull it up. Yeah, hang on.
That would be great. That would be really helpful.
Sorry.
No worries.
Okay. Banking relationships, avoidance of payday and predatory lenders. You just did that. Individual development accounts, IDAs.
Okay. Was also like credit, paying down credit in there somewhere?
Paying down debt and the value of credit score. I'm sorry, yes, it is on there.
Okay, excellent.
Those other ones.
This is one of my favorite topics, actually. Mm-hmm. Because, again, as Sky just mentioned, you know, enough debt builds up and people just fall behind. So, it was interesting. I was actually talking to a colleague the other day, and this is an issue that comes up a lot, right? If I have a bunch of debt and, you know, I feel buried by it and I don't know how to get out of it. And I just want to talk about two or three ways that, strategies that we'd like to talk about that we've stolen from other people. But the first one is called sort of the debt snowball. And actually, Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, came up with this in her book a couple of years ago. And so there's a number of ways to sort of attack debt, right? Obviously, we got to pay it down, but I just want to talk about two or three approaches that we use. So this debt snowball idea. So obviously, if there's a number of types of debt, let's say there's a credit card debt and there's a car loan, and I don't know, there's some other debt. Probably the most efficient way to go after these things is to go after, you know, the debt with the highest interest rate first. So if there's a 15% interest rate, a 10% interest rate, and an 8% interest rate, you know, going after paying down the loan with the highest interest rate is sort of makes the most sense. And you know, we can do that with graphs, and we can just do that with common sense, and that's the best way to go. But one of the things Elizabeth Warren has talked about is that, you know, sometimes, you know, financial matters and money management, it's a lot more emotional than it is sort of logical sometimes. And so one of the things that she suggests, and we've seen a lot of people be really successful with this model, is that you actually go after the smallest dollar amount loan first. So again, same scenario, maybe there's three loans, there's a $3,000 one, a $2,000 one, and a $1,000 one. You know, going after the first, or going after the lowest one, the $1,000 loan, really helps people see immediate results. You know, if you're paying down a much larger loan, even if it's a higher interest rate, sometimes that can take longer. But sometimes just paying off, you know, the smallest loan, instead of having three loans, now you have two. And that can really provide an emotional boost to people that will make a significant difference in their sticking to a debt repayment strategy. So that's one of the other ones that we talk about. And lastly, one of the things I want to talk about, because it demonstrates nicely, I think, how a little planning can make a huge difference, is we like to talk about paying down credit card debt. And we use the following example. So we say that there's a $2,000 balance on a credit card and about a 21% interest rate. And I suspect that might be a little bit of a conservative number, believe it or not, but a 21% interest rate. And, you know, the minimum payment on that might be $40 a month. So if you make the minimum payment, we've run this through a few calculators, one winds up paying, it takes a number of years to pay that back, and one winds up paying over $4,700 back on that original $2,000 credit card debt. It takes more than 10 years to do it by paying the minimum payment. So one of the things that actually we can thank CFPB for is that on everybody's credit card bill now, it shows what your minimum payment would be, and it also shows in how long it would take to pay off. But in this example, at $2,000 with a 21% interest rate, if you were to double that minimum payment just to $80, it goes from $40 to $80, you wind up paying it off in less than 3 years, and only paying about $2,680. So there's a difference there in paying $2,700 in interest versus $680, $700 in interest just by doubling the payment, because that additional payment will go directly against the principal. So again, it's one of the things we really like to talk about when paying down debt is, you know, making sure that to the extent people can, they at least double their monthly payment so that they can pay down the debt much quicker. Going to take a moment there. Any questions about sort of paying down debt, or Jackie, anything you want to jump in around these things?
Okay, that's fine, Tom.
Okie doke. One of the things we also like to talk about with regard to the credit card debt is that, you know, there's a bunch of studies out there, and I'm sure you guys, I've seen this in my own life as well. If I walk into a store or a mall or something like that with a credit card, I'm going to probably spend more than I will if I walk in with just cash. And we found these studies that, you know, have not surprisingly been commissioned by the credit card industry, that show that folks will spend up to 30% more if they have a credit card in a store than if they walk in with cash. Because, you know, I don't want to go into a store and give away cash. I like my cash. But credit cards, it really separates us from our money. So to the extent we can, we really like, you know, folks to think about using an ATM card or a debit card to make purchases. Because that also, you know, comes out immediately, and it sort of concretizes that you're actually spending real money. So one of the ways that one of the resources we like to point people to is controlyourcredit.gov. Has lots of great resources, you know, again, never just make minimum payments. You know, big fans of debit cards, etc. Okay. So speaking of credit cards, one of the other things that we talk about a lot in our trainings is your credit score. And, you know, more and more we're seeing that a credit score in itself, your credit score is an asset that people should need to pay attention to for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, your credit score is basically a measure of how well somebody pays bills over time. We know that your credit score is going to influence a number of things. First of all, it'll influence whether or not you can get credit. You know, a low enough credit score and you're just not going to get, say, a mortgage for a house. And it also will basically influence whether or not people the amount and the cost of credit. So a very low credit score can mean the difference between an 8% loan on an automobile and a 15% loan on an automobile, or having to go to a third-party loan such as the some of the predatory lenders we've talked about in the past. And not only that, but you know, even rental property, they're pulling credit reports now. We've even seen a proliferation of credit reports being pulled from an employment perspective. So people are looking at credit as one of the factors in whether or not to hire somebody for a job. So more and more, you know, the credit score itself is really a critical asset building tool. It really makes a difference about the kind of credit you can obtain, how much you'll be charged, and can really affect one's future. So, your credit score is a very carefully hidden secret, the way they come to it anyway. But, you know, basically speaking, about 35% of it is based on payment history, 30% on amounts owed, so your total credit versus amounts owed, 15% of the length of credit history, 10% any new credit, and 10% types of credit used. So,
could you repeat that, please? This is Jennifer in Kansas. Could you repeat those percentages, please?
Absolutely, and I'll go slower. Sorry about that. 35% is your payment history. 30% is the amount owed. 15% is the length of credit history. 10% is new credit. 10% is credit used. So some of those things, well, one or two of those things we don't have a lot of control over, right? You know, the length of credit, I can't make myself have a longer credit report or credit history than I already have. But certainly, you know, paying bills on time, that's the biggest one, right? 35% paying bills on time. You know, again, the more one pays down debt, it's known as the ratio of credit used. Let's say you have a total of $50,000 in available credit to you. Folks are gonna, it's gonna affect your score if you're almost maxed out with $48,000. But if you're only, you know, maybe carrying $10,000, that will improve your score. So these are the factors that we work on when we're working with people on improving their credit, usually in relationship to home purchase or something along those lines.
This is Sky in Alaska. Can you speak to what bills actually help pay, get your credit score up? And what bills actually take it down?
Excellent. Well, I don't know that, and Jackie, I think you know more about this than I do quite often, but I don't know that any bills will bring it down. Failure to pay bills will certainly bring it down.
Sky, this is Jackie. I will jump in just really quick on this. A couple of things is, you know, for the most part, like any sort of regular trade line, so credit cards, mortgages, student loans, other types of consumer loans, will end up on your credit report. Whether, like, so it comes up as a positive, like you're paying these things on time, or negative, missed payments. There's a movement out there, and it's starting to really gain some momentum, and it's around alternative data. So that would include things like utility payments. There's a great project called Rent Bureau that's being spearheaded through Credit Builders Alliance. And this is happening because, you know, for many low-income consumers in particular, they don't necessarily have a mortgage that they're paying or a car payment or student loans. And so it's difficult for a bank or a credit union or other financial institution to really assess the risk that they are because they don't have a lot of data that is regularly captured on their credit report. And so there's sort of a grassroots effort that I do see kind of gaining traction that is looking at other ways to capture information that would tell the story as to how much of a risk a person is by looking at the things that they do regularly pay.
Okay, well, one of the reasons why I asked that question, and that's Sky, this is Sky again, is I have a consumer who, her actual credit score was reduced by unpaid, her child's, disabled child's medical bills. And while it's not supposed to, the credit agencies do not give that information out, so when she's looking for apartments, and even she faced a problem with getting a very good paying job based on her credit score, and the reason the credit score was low was because of these unpaid medical bills, but they were for a juvenile. And so I've actually had her start bringing her credit report with her and saying, okay, these are unpaid medical bills due to my child's disability.
Right. Well, I mean, medical debt does show up on your credit report. So if you know, if your doctor, like what I learned when I was in Georgia, is that if your doctor, you know, if you don't pay your, you know, copay of $50, and you continue not to pay, and there's no communication, your doctor will sell that debt to a debt collecting agency. That then gets on your credit report as an unpaid, as a collection. So yeah, that will definitely pull down your credit score. And if she is the legal guardian, if she's signed and is legally responsible for those medical bills,
it's
then it really legitimately does impact her credit. The thing that, you know, we used to encourage our consumers to do is actually write a letter of explanation as to anything that's negative on a credit report. But there are some things that the Bureau is looking at, and I think others are looking at when it comes to medical debt. But if she feels like she's being harassed, or if there are things that are negatively impacting her in a bigger way, part of what I'm going to talk about later will give you some tools to be able to help her address those issues.
Yeah, because this whole issue with them pulling the credit report for a job, to me, is just insane. And
it's very, very common.
It's becoming very common, but it seems like it's almost a misuse of that information, because that doesn't tell you anything about the employee, honestly, to me. Especially in this case with this particular person, all it says is that she has a child who's had 3 transplants, and she's paying down an enormous debt. Not hiring her isn't going to help that situation. That's my opinion.
Right.
Jackie, who's the letter to be written to that you mentioned?
So basically, let me give a little bit of context, and then I'll answer that question, Kathy.
Okay.
Probably it's going to sound like it's going to come out of left field unless I do. Prior to joining the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, I ran a nonprofit loan fund, and we did loans for individuals with disabilities and their family members and other caregivers for assistive technology. And then as part of those wraparound services, we also provided financial education, credit education, individual development accounts, and when we had funding, free tax preparation. So when we would have customers come to us seeking a loan, because we did that, we did loans, and we would pull their credit report and we would evaluate it and do sort of a pretty intensive manual process of review. We didn't use one of the automated systems, because that's part of what people are running into, is that many, you know, companies that provide credit kind of pull down the credit report and essentially, like, it's a very, you know, sort of, okay, all I'm going to look at is the score, and that doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot. And so what we would do is, if we had a person that had a fairly low credit score, we would ask them as part of their application for credit to provide us with an explanation of any derogatory information on their credit report that we should take into account. Now, of course, for us, because our mission was to serve individuals with disabilities, medical debt like that would essentially just be ignored in our underwriting process. We would encourage them to, like, set up payment plans so that they can begin to, you know, pay down that debt, or to, you know, talk to a credit counselor if it was a very complicated situation. And if it was something where the insurance company should have paid for it, and there was like a dispute between the individual and the insurance company, then at that point it becomes disputing the debt itself. so that it you stop getting sort of pinged in the collections and the fees and everything else on top of it.
So it's to the loaning agency that you're writing this letter.
Yes.
Then.
So whoever you're trying to get credits from.
Gotcha.
And you know, frankly, I would advise anyone you're trying to, you know, if you know that a potential employer is going to pull your credit, then I would certainly have sort of ready on hand a letter explanation that simply says, "I understand I have the following medical debts. These are true debts. I attempted to make payment, you know, arrangements that would fit within my budget," and tell your story. It may or may not make a difference, but you go on record basically saying, "I'm a responsible person," because that's essentially what they're trying to gather. You know, are you a responsible person, and do you have any fraud?
This may be jumping way ahead. How do you go about, though, when you're making payments? This is Sky again. When you're making payments, getting the credit agencies to keep up with your payments and taking it off of the account. Because in her case, she had been making payments for quite some time, and none of them were credited to her credit score. We had to call and call and call, and we had to call all three and try and do that. It's a Herculean feat just to get them to respond.
Yeah, and they don't talk to each other. So anytime you want, these are competitors. They have zero communication with each other. So if you want to dispute something that's incorrect, you write a single dispute letter and send it three times.
Hmm. Triplicate fun.
Yes.
Absolutely. Jackie, I was going to talk about a couple resources around credit stuff, but I know you guys are one of them. Would now be a good time to talk about some of that?
Sure. So I can sort of segue into kind of my part of this, and feel free anybody to jump in with questions. I don't mind that one bit. So my name is Jackie Wilkes, and I am an outreach specialist within the Office of Financial Empowerment, which is one of the divisions at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And here, you know, the Bureau was born out of Senator Elizabeth Warren's vision to sort of correct the imbalance in the financial marketplace that occurred after the recent crash. And so the Bureau is designed to, it has a few statutory objectives. And so, you know, in its sort of most simplest form, it's to ensure that consumers have timely and understandable information so that they can make informed decisions about financial transactions. We're here to protect consumers from unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices and from discrimination, to reduce unnecessary or overly burdensome regulations, and that's largely, you know, for the financial institutions that we supervise, to promote fair competition, and again, that applies to, you know, trying to sort of level the playing field, not for consumers from that perspective, but so that, you know, many banks have often complained about the non-bank players in the financial marketplace that aren't subject to the same regulations, and so they don't have to bear the cost of compliance, and therefore they can discount their products. And so there's some leveling going on. And that, you know, we try to advance market so that the financial products and services really are transparent and that there is an opportunity to consider innovation. Some of you on the phone might be familiar with my manager, Cliff Rosenthal. Cliff is the assistant director for our office, and he came here about a year ago from the National Federation of Community Development Credit Unions. And so his sort of lens into all of this is that there has to be a better way. There has to be better financial products and services that are readily available, accessible for all low-income individuals and economically vulnerable, including people with disabilities. He has been an incredible internal advocate around trying to make sure that every conversation that happens around, you know, financial products financial services? How do we do outreach? Are we getting our information into the community? It's fully inclusive. And that is part of the reason why I'm here. So it is essentially my job to make sure outreach is done in general, but also very specifically to actively engage the disability community. And so that is basically my way of saying, please reach out to me. If you have questions, Sky, it sounds like you have some really rich and interesting and frustrating situations happening. And there are a couple of things that, a couple of tools that the Bureau has readily available that I would encourage you to kind of find your way around and then help your consumers to see if one of these things can help them.
Jackie, this is Kathy again. Are there some things that we can put on the April website that would be good?
Yes.
Okay.
I can send you, we have like a one-page slide that will basically say these are our tools that are available, and mm-hmm. they're essentially links to some key resources on our website.
That's perfect, yeah.
The two that are my favorite, actually there's three that are my favorite, but the two that are most used and I think are really relevant for this conversation, particularly in light, Sky, you've sort of bubbled up a lot of issues that I think are very real that we should talk about. One is submitting a complaint. And so if you feel like something, has gone wrong, like, there has been some type of abuse, some type of misinformation, your financial institution won't cooperate or work with you, there are, things that you can do to receive a remedy. And so right now, there are eight different things that you can submit a complaint on. So a bank account or service. So in situations like that, it might be that you have, I heard recently, and actually at a meeting with Director Cordray, who is now officially our director, so we should be very, very excited about that. He had a youth account that, he was talking about that he had opened for one of his children. And they had, it was a savings account, and the bank had charged him, and this was prior to him being here at the Bureau, but the bank had been charging them inactivity fees. So, his kids started off with a couple $100, and the savings was being eaten away with monthly inactivity fees. So that's one area. Credit cards. So there's a lot of complaints around credit card companies, either billing at the wrong times, taking out too much money, double billing, whatever the case may be. Interest rates, so if you feel like, you're not getting a good interest rate or the interest rate you think you deserve, and you think that the reason behind that is either because where you live or some other factor, you can submit a complaint there. Credit reporting, so Sky, this might be an area because the Bureau does have sort of jurisdiction to and supervises all the three major credit reporting agencies. So it's TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. So there's a way to submit a complaint there. Debt collection.
Jackie, one quick question. We had a question from somebody on the cart that wanted to know what, before you go on beyond the three big agencies, what is a good score and what's the range of scores?
That's a great question. And there's the range of scores is, I would say, not a definitive range. So it really does depend on which model you're using. But typically it is from 300 to 850. Tom, is that right?
Yes.
But, there are some other models that look at that differently, but that gives you a sense of it.
Yep.
Nowadays, a great credit score is 720 plus. Go ahead, Tom.
I just wanted to say, with regard to credit and what Sky was talking about earlier, one of the things you guys just put out, which is, I think could be really useful for folks, are sort of templates for letters around credit collection that was just added to your guys' website, what, yesterday or the day before that?
Yes.
And so, because, Mike, I have no idea how to write a letter to a credit reporting agency, so CFPB has put, I think, half a dozen of them up as models that people can copy and download, which is just perfect for this particular conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Yeah, we're always adding new things, and so part of my job doing outreach is to make sure that I'm getting that out. If you are not on my distribution list and would like to be, just send me an email. Or, you know, Kathy, if you and I want to talk about sending just an introductory email about the Bureau and seeing if people want to be on the list, that would be great.
Okay.
There are some, you know...
I can put your email addresses, too, for both of you guys on the website, if you'd like, with the aisle conversation.
Sure.
That'd be great.
Okay.
And I'll just quickly talk about the four other things that you can submit a complaint on. One is money transfer, so remittances to, you know, either within the U.S. or outside, mortgages, student loans, and vehicle and consumer loans. So there are lots of, you know, opportunities here. That's an ever-growing list of things. But something that I just want to point out, and I think it's really interesting for those of us that are self-proclaimed data nerds, you can get on the website and actually pull down data and run some reports about the kinds of complaints that are happening in your community. So, for example, you know, we did a listening session about a month ago in Philadelphia, and we just started looking at how many complaints were filed. And that really sort of wound people up because, you know, there was only, I want to say, like, a little over 900 complaints filed in, you know, whatever zip codes we put in for Philadelphia. And Philadelphia is a relatively large urban area, and so one of the things that sort of emerged from that is that people didn't know, like the information wasn't out there, that you could submit a complaint and that there would be something, a response. And, you know, I work here and, you know, and I will tell you that the complaint system is very low barrier. So it is, you know, you do have to put in your information. But it is not difficult to navigate at all. Once you have submitted your complaint, you know, this goes in and the complaint is reviewed and then actually routed to whomever the company is that you're complaining about. And in the complaint process, you actually put in there, what is it you want? Do you want the fees waived? Do you want a reduction in your interest? Like, you sort of lay out, you know, what I call, in my perfect world, this would happen. Then the company is given a pretty short turnaround time to respond, and then you get a copy of that response. Like, the company will say, okay, here's the background of what happened. This is the information that we have. And then the person who complained or submitted the complaint then has the opportunity to respond. And at that point, you can either do nothing and be like, okay, fine, that's great, that's what I wanted to have happen, or you can dispute it. And, you know, the idea of peer pressure is not only true for teenage girls. It also holds very true for banking institutions. They do not want to see, because this complaint data is completely public. Like, if you wanted to know how many people, you know, in the nation submitted a complaint on credit cards and you wanted to know who most of those credit card complaints were filed against, you could get that information. That's not really good press. And so they do try to respond, and they try to respond in a way that will not result in a dispute. The other thing that happens sort of beyond that is that complaint data is shared with state and federal law enforcement agencies. And so if there is something that gets flagged within this, and this is where you have to make sure that your complaint is really captures some of the information, that if there is some violation of a federal law, these complaints get routed to the appropriate agencies for follow-up. And then there are, you know, the great thing is there are actual human beings that man this account and look at the complaints and route them to the right people and make sure that, you know, the Bureau is responding to the public. The other thing that you can do similar to this is, you know, tell your story. And, Kathy, you and I talked about this real briefly, but there is a feature on here where you can essentially, you know, write a story about this is your experience with a financial institution or with a credit company or whatever it is related to products and services that sort of fall into one of our buckets. Every month we have an all-hands meeting in my division, and there is a story that is read. And they are read as a reminder that the work that we do sitting here in our little offices, you know, staring at a computer screen most of the time, that, you know, what's behind that work are the people that are being impacted by the things that we do. And so it's because it's all text, there's, you know, no easy way to kind of dig in there for, you know, people telling stories, you know, if they have a disability or if their disability they think played a part in what had happened to them. But I do try to look for that, and, you know, I am always looking to get feedback around any one of the topics that I've mentioned, good or bad. You know, let's talk about what happened. Some of you live in communities where there's some really amazing, innovative financial products and services and collaborations and partnerships that are taking off, that are actually helping people with disabilities become more economically self-sufficient. And so I have sort of this dream of launching a campaign around Tell Your Story, and, you know, I would gather these things and, you know, really be able to paint a good picture for the leadership here around what it means to be a person with a disability who is an active player in the financial marketplace. So that's my sort of plea to all of you. And then the third thing that I wanted to mention, and again, this is something that I think is a really useful tool, Kathy, that could be highlighted on your website, and that would be our Ask CFPB. And this is essentially, I think we have several thousand questions that people have asked us on various topics, from, you know, the basics of, you know, managing your money, payday loans, prepaid cards, you know, closing costs or housing counseling, credit cards, whatever the topic is. And there's a search button, and you can just go in and type in your question, and it will try to find the answer of something that you would like to know. And if we don't have the answer, if it comes up, sorry, nothing matches what you've asked, that actually gets captured and routed internally. And then that's how more questions get added. So the question might get asked around, you know, how do I dispute improper medical debt or something? And if we don't have the answer to that, it gets routed through the digital team and then back to the subject matter experts. So that would likely hit my desk. I would then work with our Fair Lending Office and the folks that do supervisions of credit reporting agencies to get the correct answer and to create tools for consumers to be able to appropriately handle those types of situations. So I feel like we're, you know, for a federal agency, we're very transparent. That is probably the one thing that I've learned pretty quickly, is that if you want to know something about the CFPB, it's out there. But also dynamic. And not just me. You know, I have team members within my Office of Financial Empowerment, colleagues within the Division of Consumer Education and Engagement, and then, you know, colleagues in other parts of the Bureau that really care about making sure that financial products and services are fair, that they are accessible, and that, you know, we as, you know, as a Bureau are responding to the needs that are emerging. And part of the way that we do that is by having these listening sessions. There are field hearings that come up basically once a month, where Director Cordray is out in the field. The next one is actually going to be in September in Mississippi. And so, you know, we are really trying to actively, you know, announce these meetings and to let, you know, people that live in the local community know about it. So if they're interested in attending, it's an open and public meeting, they can. If they can't attend, there's often the opportunity to watch it via live stream. And so to finding ways to engage the public, because everything that we learn while we're out in the community comes back in and informs the work that we do in our offices. And I'll pause there for questions or clarification.
Jackie, this is Rosemary from Independent Living in West Plains. How often should somebody get a credit score report, and where is the best place to get one?
That's a great question. General advice is that you should check your credit score at least, or your credit report at least once a year. And I think that's a pretty standard kind of answer that you're going to get. I always often encourage people that if they know that they are going to be making a big purchase, so buying a home, buying a car, applying for student loans, something, you know, that is going to clearly pull your credit, or if you're going back to work or you're looking for a new job, to go ahead and pull it a couple of months prior to, so that if there are any errors on your credit report, that you will have time to fix them. And then your second question was?
Where to get the report.
Oh, where to get annualcreditreport.com. Thanks, Tom.
Yep. And, you know, you're legally entitled to one free credit report from each of the three major credit reporting agencies per year. And the website set up to do that is annualcreditreport.com. And for folks,
Sorry, this is Sky. You have a question on the annualcreditreport.com. I have a consumer who is a domestic violence victim, and
mm-hmm.
due to having to relocate so many times, she's having an issue with annualcreditreport.com because she cannot get her, because some of her addresses, due to them being secure, it's posing a barrier, and it's not the first time I've heard this.
Sure.
Scott,
you know,
you and I can talk about that.
Awesome. Thank you.
And we can do that offline, but certainly.
Perfect. Thank you.
Well, and I also had two other suggestions. So for folks who aren't net users, to get that report, you can call 1-877-322-8228.
Could you repeat it one more
time? Absolutely. It's 877-322-8228.
Perfect. Thank you.
And then another resource that we recommend is another website called creditkarma.com. They consolidate all three credit reports and will track it. It's a free service. They're funded through advertising. It's a free and secure service. We don't have any sort of relationship with them or anything, but it's been a pretty useful website that has really helped out around credit reporting in our experience as well.
And I always like to remind folks that when you go and you do get your free credit report, it is just your report. You do not get your credit score with that. You have to pay for that separately.
And that's one of the nice things about Credit Karma is for free. They'll give you your score, actually. Okay.
That's interesting. They gave you the report, but not the number, huh?
That's because
that was the lawsuit.
Huh.
Yeah, it's because the score and the, what do they call that, the algorithm that creates the score based upon the percentages that Tom shared with you, that is proprietary information that is held by Fair Isaac. And they want to keep that information, they want you to pay for it.
And in addition,
how
I suspect...
Sorry, go ahead.
You know, folks know there's also been lawsuits that, you know, if you want your credit report in Braille, you can get your credit report in Braille. They have to make it accessible to folks with disabilities as well.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions at this point?
This is Jennifer in Kansas, and I just have a quick comment. I've also had consumers pull a report from an agency every 4 months, and that way, although they're pulling, like, say, from TransUnion annually, if they're wanting to clear something up and they're not in a big hurry, then they can pull that second report from another place, and they don't all talk together, but you can at least, it's a way to maintain monitoring and still see a report every 4 months at no cost. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's a great suggestion.
Yeah, that's really good advice. The other thing that that does, I think, is, you know, people, you know, creditors choose what to report and what not to report. And the flip side of that is the credit reporting agencies choose what information to accept and what information not to accept. So if you happen to be one of those people, like me, I confess, that, you know, when I do pull my credit reports, I do that all on the same day, and, you know, I kind of clean up my financial life, you know, every couple months. I lay them out all out together, and all three reports are different.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it creates a pretty big burden around that, but, you know, as, you know, advocates, you know, you have to make sure that you are sharing with the consumers that you serve that it's really important to, you know, not just take them on face value, but to pull each one and then to think about, you know, what information is on them. And if you dispute the information on one report, to make sure you send that to all three to kind of put everything in the on the same playing field.
Could you all talk a little bit about maybe home ownership and retirement planning strategies?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I will jump in. These are some of my favorite things. I mean, I read about this stuff in my spare time for fun. I don't get out much. Anyway, yes, be delighted to. So home ownership. So one of the reasons we talk about home ownership so much is that for folks with disabilities, you know, it's a great way to build assets over the long haul. It also obviously provides a place to live. And, you know, folks can really put down roots in the community. In addition to that, it's not a countable asset with regard to any sort of benefit programs. So homeownership is just a great resource for folks with disabilities. But, you know, one of the other reasons that we like to talk about it is that it's a financial asset in a number of ways we don't often think about. So think about these. If I had a PowerPoint up in front of you, it would look like this. So on the left-hand side, it would say 2006, 2010, and 2012. So what we did a little research. We looked to see what it cost to rent a 1,200-square-foot house in 2006, 2010, and 2012. And we're out here in California, so the numbers are probably a little bit higher here than other places. But in 2006, the cost of that house out here in California was about $1,000 a month. In 2010, it was about $1,150 a month. In 2012, it was about $1,300 a month. What we know is that rents are going to continue to go up, right? And, you know, that's no surprise. Here in 2013, the cost of renting has gone up even more. And so, you know, that's how rent works. It just continues to go up over time. But one of the really interesting things that happened in 2006 is we all remember interest rates were a little bit higher then. But if we took the same house and we looked at the price of a mortgage on that same house, the mortgage on that house was about $1,330 a month. So it was substantially higher back in 2006. However, over the last couple of years, interest rates have dropped, right? So that same house with that mortgage, by the way, that was a 7% mortgage in 2006, about a $200,000 mortgage. In 2010, interest rates had dropped. They were in the fives.
in 2010, that same payment would have been $1,136, which was just about even with what it, the rent would have been in 2010. And, of course, if we jump to 2012, when interest rates were at the lowest, you know, in quite a long time, that same $200,000 mortgage was down to $958 a month. Hmm. So what we see, obviously, is that there's a huge, there can be a huge advantage to owning rather than buying, particularly if you like stability, because regardless of what interest rate you get, if one gets a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, which is the only thing we suggest folks get, you know, your mortgage payment in year one is going to be, in this case, you know, with current interest rates, $958 a month. That'll be your mortgage rate in year 5, in year 10, in year 15, in year 20. And with a 30-year mortgage rate, it'll be the same in year 30. Of course, in year 31, you won't have a mortgage anymore because it's been paid off. And, you know, one of the big financial assets in most people's, in many people's lives, is home ownership. So also when we look at that $200,000 mortgage, over 30 years, even if houses just appreciate as they have historically in the U.S., that would be a house worth more in excess of $400,000 at the end of that 30-year period. That's just based on 2.5%, 3% inflation over time. So one thinks, you know, well, fabulous, you know, you have a $400,000 house at the end of 30 years, but what do you do with it then? Well, again, it's an asset, right? Not only is it a place to live, not only is one put down roots in the community, but now you have an asset that you can start to borrow back against if you need to. One of the things, and I won't get really deep into it, but there's a product on the market called a reverse mortgage. It's eligible to people who are 62 and older, and actually CFPB has lots of good information about reverse mortgages on their website as well. But because a reverse mortgage, it's basically just what it sounds like. The bank pays you instead of you paying the bank. And at the end of a fixed period of time, the bank would get the house, or, as you know, would get the house if the person passed away. The neat part about that for folks with disabilities is that it's an income stream. And it's an income stream that isn't technically considered earnings from any sort of benefit level. So hopefully in 30 years, our benefit systems will make a lot more sense than they do now. But under current rules, somebody with a reverse mortgage, even if they were pulling $1,000 out a month, it wouldn't be considered income for any purposes of around benefits or Medicaid or anything like that. So, again, lots of different ways to get into it. There are, you know, veterans programs that have like 0% down payments. There's lots of first-time home buyer programs. You know, you can use borrowed funds. You can use gifted funds. Lots of ways to sort of structure that. And I'd be really happy to talk with anyone about home ownership strategies, you know, more offline or, you know, at folks' convenience. Okay. So, sorry, was there a question there?
No, I don't know. Is there a question? No?
Okay, great.
Okay.
And we're even sort of on time and stuff. So, before I go on to the retirement thing, let me just jump into one more thing that Jackie kind of touched on a little bit back in her Georgia days, is filing taxes. And, you know, I didn't say this in the beginning, but I'm a tax lawyer by training. So it always makes me a little nervous when I stand up in front of a room and I'm saying, hey, I'm a tax lawyer, and I'm encouraging everybody to go out and file your taxes, because that just feels wrong. But one of the things, particularly in the disability community, that we spend some time talking about is the earned income tax credit. So for folks who are working, you know, they're eligible for this earned income tax credit. And long story made short, this is a credit that doesn't automatically show up on a lot of the software. It's a credit that a lot of people don't know about. But basically, if one is working, you're entitled to the earned income tax credit. There are also child tax credits as well. One of the reasons this has been such a hot issue in the disability community is that it's been estimated that nearly $900 million goes unclaimed in the disability community alone nationally because of the earned income tax credit. And sometimes what happens is people, you know, they might be working a little bit, they might make a couple hundred bucks a month, or
you know, only earn a few thousand dollars a year, and there's no requirement to file one's taxes because one hasn't earned enough. But by not filing, one is also not going to be eligible for the earned income tax credit. And it really varies the amount one can get back. A single individual filing separately, the maximum is $450. But by the time, you know, maybe it's a single mom with a couple of kids, it can be $2,000-$3,000. The other reason we like to talk about this is it has a look back provision. You can go back 3 years, and I have the opportunity out here in California to work on the Oakland EITC committee, and every year there's two or three or four people that we find, you know, it's a single mom, they haven't paid their taxes in a while, they're afraid to pay their taxes in a while. They go back and they file retroactively, and rather than being, you know, turning out that they owe a bunch of money, because of the tax credit and the child credit, sometimes they get back, you know, two, three, five. Last year we had some people getting back $10,000-$11,000.
Wow.
And that's really change your life kind of money, you know, if you're a single mom with a couple of kids. And, you know, it can really be, it can provide the down payment on a house, it can pay off some bills, it can, you know, secure safe transportation to get to work every day. And this is all, you know, this $900 million is money that, you know, individuals with disabilities are leaving on the table by not filing taxes. In addition, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars can be saved by participating in the volunteer income tax preparation, local preparation program, where, you know, volunteers will actually prepare the folks' taxes for free, you know, saving the tax preparation fees, which can, you know, range from anywhere from, you know, $100 to $300, at least out here. So again, earned income tax credit, having folks with disabilities file their taxes, is another asset building strategy that, you know, can really yield some results. Jackie, you want to pop in anything on that, or anybody have any questions?
This is Jennifer from Kansas again. I have another comment. On the EIC, though, it is earned income. You have to have actual earnings, not just income from benefits, correct?
Correct. That's a great question. Okay.
Okay, well, then I guess that answers my question, Ms. Sky, again, because I put that, does that apply to people that only got unemployment for the year? And you're saying, no, it has to be earned income.
Correct.
Okay.
But, you know, it could also be, it can be from self-employment, you know, if you're up in Alaska, you know, shoveling snow, something like that. I hear you get a lot of it there.
That and dog mushing, you'll be surprised. There's a lot of people who get employment through dog mushing.
Excellent.
Or caring for dogs.
Excellent. Dogs are some of my favorite things. Let me hit on two or three more things just really quickly from a financial perspective. One is that's on the, I think we said we were going to talk about, is the individual development account. Real quickly. Yes, ma'am.
And let me ask you real quick, though. I had another question about on the chat here about home ownership stuff.
Oh, please.
Is there a website where you can find a list of home ownership programs such as veterans, first-time home buyers, or any for people with disabilities, et cetera?
Not generally, but what we do suggest is you pick the geographic location you're looking at. Uh-oh.
Somebody put it on hold.
Go ahead. You pick a geographic location that you want to live in. So let's... I want to start dancing.
No kidding. Oh, dear. That somebody has put us on hold and doesn't realize that they can't do that. Can you talk over it?
Well, I wonder... Yeah, I think I can talk over it. What, you know, lots of people say that I talk over things anyway. So the best thing to do would be to pick the city that you want to live in, put it into a Google search and say, you know, Oakland first-time homebuyer program or Oakland disability homebuyer program, because there's going to be more local resources available than there will be national ones. And sometimes in Oakland, just the other day, I saw one that was they had $20,000 of down payment assistance, and it was in a grant through the city. So a grant through the city. So that wouldn't probably show up on a national one. So, you know, Google knows everything.
Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have any way of knowing who that is.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah.
When I'm talking to...
Can we do a method of elimination? This is Sky.
Hi, Sky. Hey, Sky, before I forget, can you send me an email at some point today? It's just tom@wid.org. I'd like to follow up with you about something else as well.
Yes, sir.
Great.
And this is Jackie. I just want to thank everybody for joining us.
Your call is important to us.
Well, I'm glad it waited until 20 after 4.
I just want to, Kathy, thank you so much for inviting us to participate on one of these calls. It's been really great. And please feel free to share my contact information if there's anything that I said that anyone wants more information on, or I'll also pull together some of the key resources that we have that we talked about in terms of, you know, where to go to file the complaint, tell your story, or ask CFPB.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, anybody is welcome to reach out to me directly. My email is just my name, jacqueline.wilkes@cfpb.gov, and it's rather long and hard to spell, but I'm sure Kathy will be kind enough to send it out to the group. And, you know, I do look forward to continuing the conversation. If there are things that are happening in your community that you think we need to be aware of, let us know. And, of course, Tom, I always enjoy presenting with you, so thanks so much for that opportunity.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It sounds like our person must have come back on the line. Whoever went off the line and put us on hold, we've listened to your music. So if you need to go on hold, this is just for everybody. Always use *6 first, and then you can click off. But don't just put us on hold, because then if you have music on your answering machine, we'll listen to that, and that just doesn't work. One last thing before we do finish up, though. I think, Tom, you started to talk about the individual development accounts, IDAs. Did you want to mention a little bit about that?
Sure. Let me just hit a couple of things before we check out here. So an IDA is a match savings account. It's specifically to save for home ownership, small business development, or college education. The really cool part about these is that they're a match savings. So, you know, if you put away $100, it's matched with another $100 if it's a one-to-one account. Some of them have a 2-to-1 match. Some of them have a 3-to-1 match. And the reason that it's limited to home ownership, small business development, and education is those are three things that are really strongly linked to economic success over the long term. These programs are available nationally. Again, much like first-time homebuyer programs, the best way to find one in your area is to put in, you know, Oakland, California IDA program. You know, they come with financial education. They're targeted towards lower-income people. Lots of the IDA programs have spent time doing outreach to people with disabilities. And without getting into it, there are some disability benefit disregards that are part of IDA programs that are very, very attractive to folks on Medicaid or SSI. But it's a great way to come up with the down payment for a home, or to come up with some money to go back to school, or even start a small business. And so an IDA is a really powerful tool to do that. And then I wanted to hit a little bit on retirement programs, you know, not only for people that we all work with, but, you know, for those of us that work for nonprofits, they usually don't have fantastic retirement programs. So, you know, one of the things that we like to talk about is, you know, just the power of starting early from a retirement standpoint. And the number that we use is we say, you know, maybe people could put away like $100 a month, right? And the graph that I have shows three different people, and, you know, one person starts at age 16, and they put away $100 a month, and they
stop saving at age 26. So that's
hey,
just
Tom?
10 years. Yes.
This is Jackie. I'm so sorry, but I have to jump off of this call for another meeting.
Yep, go for it.
I just wanted to say thank you, and Kathy and Tom, we can touch base later this week or next week about any follow-up issues. And thank you to everybody on the call. It's been a pleasure.
Jackie, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Have a great day.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
You bet. Take care.
Go ahead and finish up.
Anyway, again, you know, start at age 16, just save for 10 years. The money comes out to about $162,000 a year. That's investor one. Investor two starts at age 40, goes to age 65. It's a 25-year period. Their accumulated earnings at 65 comes out to only about $70,000. And it's really interesting, right? Because it's 25 years of $100 a month versus 10 years in the previous. But this is the whole idea of time value of money, starting early much better. Obviously, it's even better if that same 16-year-old were to save $100 a month until he was age 65. Excuse me. In that situation, that person comes out with over $350,000 in savings. Just two quick sort of other pieces around retirement savings that I think are important. Is one of the things we also like to talk about is the management fees. You know, you take two people, again, person number one, again, saving $100 a month over 40 years. Somebody, the interest rate that we use on this is 10%. So $100 a month, 40 years over 10 years, with a 2% management fee, is about $335,000 in accumulated earnings. If the same person puts away that $100 a month over that 40 years with a 0.4 management fee, equals $522,000. It's nearly a $200,000 difference because the fees really add up over time and actually take a piece out of one's portfolio every single month. Again, we don't have any vested interest in this, but there's a mutual fund company called Vanguard who tends to have very low expenses on all their investments. 0.19% is their average. The industry average is about 1.4. So, again, we'd love to be funded by Vanguard. We're not, but, you know, for people recommending savings for people or in our own situations, we really like to talk about it. And lastly, retirement savings. A graph just came across my desk the other day, and I love graphs. Why the blind guy loves graphs, I don't know. But basically what it showed was holding periods in the stock market and annual returns. And long story made short, from an investment standpoint, with a 20-year holding period, there has never been a time in the history of the United States where people lost money in the stock market with a 20-year time horizon. So, you know, returns in the stock market tend to outpace any other sorts of returns. So, you know, expense ratios, staying in the stock market for long periods of time, not jumping in and out, and starting early are sort of the three main keys to long-term, you know, retirement success. Not only for folks with disabilities, but for everybody. And with that, I think I'm actually on time. And I want to thank Jackie, who's gone, and Kathy, and everybody on the phone as well. My name's Tom. I work at WID. I have a really easy email, tom@wid.org. And if anybody has any questions or follow-up concerns, I'd be delighted to chat with you. Thanks again for the opportunity, Kathy.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. That was a lot of really good information, I think. I hope everybody felt the same way. So I'd like to thank you. Are there any last questions? Does anybody have a last question before we sign off for today? No? Okay. Well, again, thanks to Jackie and to Tom, our presenters. Also, thank you to the CART folks and to our friends at Skill in Kansas for recording our call. I'd like to, again, invite you to visit the April website where you'll find, hopefully, a few more links and documents that we discussed today. We'll get those up in the next few days. And an archived copy of and a transcript of this. We will have an audio copy and a transcript. Just go to april-rural.org and look for Aisle Conversations. And if you have any questions about today's discussion, you can reach me at Kat Hatch, that's K-A-T-H-A-T-C-H, at charter.net.
And again, this is an IELTS conversation, and it is presented by the IELTSnet, which is operated by Independent Living Research Utilization Program at TIRR Memorial Hermann in partnership with Nickel and April. Support for the presentation was provided by the U.S. Department of Education Rehabilitation Services Administration. No official endorsement of the Department of Education should be inferred. So again, thanks everybody, and have a great evening. We appreciate you being on the call. Take good care. Bye.